Thank you. Well, good morning, everybody. I first met Gary about 15 years ago, something like that. He was an alcoholic. And he would often come to the church with alcohol, disguised in a lemonade bottle. But of course, the people on the door knew Gary and they would take it off of him. And he would sit up the back there and he'd be muttering away through the service. And I quickly decided, he's an alcoholic. I put a label on him, alcoholic, waste of time. I don't want to bother with him. But the minister here had other ideas, because about a year after I first come into contact with Gary, he rang me and he said, "Do you know Gary?" And I said, "Yeah, I know Gary." He said, "Well, I've heard that he's got a doctor's appointment next Wednesday at 10:30, and it's really important that he keeps this appointment. Would you go down there to his house and make sure that he gets to the doctor?" And I thought, I didn't say, "Really? Me? Not me. I don't like the bloke." But my minister asked me to do something, so I did it. I went down to Gary's little bedsit at Mount Pleasant, knocked on the door. I was there at 10:30, so I was early. Now, there was a bit of a clue as to what was behind the door, because there was a hole punched in the door. I later learned this big hole, somebody punched it. So that was a little bit of a clue. But when he came to the door, he'd been drinking quite a lot, actually. But I was early, so he invited me in. And honestly, I cannot exaggerate what a tip this place was. Complete tip. It was, as I say, it's hard to describe. But what I did notice was there were lots of empty cider bottles lying all over the place. I think it was called White Lightning in those days. But he was very hospitable, because he offered me a cup of tea. And when I looked at this little area of, I don't know what it was really, but there was a drain and so on, and there were cups. I don't know how often they've been washed up. I said, okay, I thought, he's trying to be hospitable. I agreed. I had a cup of tea. And I can still remember it. I sent up a prayer and said, "God, you got me into this. Please protect me from..." I drank the tea and I was fine. Went down to the surgery, which was literally just a couple of minutes down the road. And we walked in and they knew Gary straight away in reception. "Oh, Gary, great to see you. Yeah, fine. You should have been here yesterday on Tuesday morning at 10:30. Ah. Right, so we rebooked the appointment, and I went again with him, I think it was the following week, and this time we did get in to see the doctor, who refused to treat him, because he'd been drinking, not the doctor, Gary, he'd been drinking, and he said, "I've told you before, Gary, I am not wasting my time with you if you've been drinking, because I'll prescribe something, you'll walk out of here and you'll completely forget it and you won't do it." And he pulled Gary's file out. I'm not exaggerating. It was that thick. He'd obviously seen him many times. So I said to him, "Well, is there anything that we can do?" And he said, "Well, there is an organization in Slough. They might be able to help you." And he gave me a card. And I contacted this organization. And they sent along, he was brilliant. He was about 30 years old. His name was Dave. And he agreed to come and visit Gary with me, which we did. And he said, "Right." He said, "The first thing we need to do is to get Gary detoxed. We need to get him into Heatherwood. I'll make the appointment now." Gary agreed to this, and he did. It was the sort of following Monday or whenever it was, Monday morning, 9 o'clock. "Fine. We'll come and pick you up, Gary." Okay. When we got outside, Dave said to me, "Now look, we've told him we'll collect him at 8 o'clock, but we'll get here at 7 o'clock before he starts drinking, because they will not admit him if he's been drinking. They just won't admit him. That's their policy." So sure enough, next Monday, we went round at 7 o'clock, knocked on the door. Gary came to the door, and he'd been drinking. He'd been drinking all night, actually. And Dave said, "Well, there still might be a chance. If we can get a big breakfast into him and lots of black coffee, we might be able to get him admitted." And that's what we did. And he was admitted into Heatherwood Hospital. Well, over the next week, I visited him regularly. And, of course, after 24 hours, he was completely sober. And then I saw the individual, because my prejudice, of course, was, he's an alcoholic, he's a waste of time. Now I saw the individual. And it turned out that he was a very intelligent man. And some of you that have known him from all those years ago might be surprised about that. But he was. He was a very intelligent man. Very articulate. Very great sense of humour. And he started to tell me his story over the week. He'd been in the army in Northern Ireland. And he'd seen things that really human beings shouldn't have to see. And he started describing them. And I'm not going to tell you this morning. But I said, that's enough, Gary. I don't want to hear any more. Thanks. But at that time, in the army, in Northern Ireland, it was a drinking culture. So you come back off a patrol and you straight into the bar and you'd be drinking. So when he left the army, he was an alcoholic. He was married. He had a couple of kids. But of course, after some little while, his wife had had enough. He was always in a drunken stupor and she left him. And she then lived, I think, in southwest London. But he wasn't allowed to see the children at all. I can understand that. I mean, he was just always drunk. But when he was telling me this, he had tears in his eyes, and so did I. So the week went past, completely detoxed. He was coming out on the Saturday, and just by coincidence, maybe it wasn't, I don't know, but I'd already booked to go on holiday for 2 weeks, a long time before I came into contact with Gary, and off I went. And when I came back, I saw Gary, and he didn't even recognize me because he was drunk. And I learned later that as soon as he came out of the hospital, he started drinking again. And I saw him a few times around the town after that, and he didn't even remember going into Heatherwood Hospital. And a year, 18 months later, I'd heard that he died. And I was very sad. But I learned two things. I learned two things from that. First one is, unless somebody really, really, really wants to stop an addiction, it's not going to happen. You can support them all you want. You can encourage them. But they have got to really want to do it. And I don't think Gary ever really did, for whatever reason. But the other thing I learned, and this is what I want to talk about this morning, obviously, is that it's about prejudice. You know, a preconceived opinion, which is what I had with Gary. Because I'd stuck this label on him. He was an alcoholic, waste of time, not worth bothering with. I didn't see the individual at all. But there was a great individual there when I got to know him and learned about him. But we do this all the time, don't we? We have these prejudices. We make these snap decisions. We do it all the time. A great example, there are lots of examples, but I was thinking about this. Football. You know, you have two teams, you have two sets of fans, and of course they're prejudiced for their own team. But when it becomes extreme, what happens? We've seen it, haven't we, on the television? Fights break out, violence breaks out, places get smashed up, people are stabbed and even killed. Extreme violence, extreme prejudice. Dare I mention this one? Politics. Politics. I mean, at the moment, the prejudice. I can't remember seeing a sensible debate about Brexit for probably 18 months. It immediately descends into sort of name calling and all sorts of stuff. It's prejudice. It's extreme prejudice. You can't even have a discussion, a proper discussion. And there are lots of other examples, aren't there, about people's gender, their sexuality, their race, their nationality, where they're from, and of course, yes, religion. In fact, the government quite recently have said, haven't they, that they have recognised now that Christians are being persecuted around the world. There's a committee, I think, looking into this, the great prejudice, where Christians are being excluded from their communities. They're being thrown into prison. They're being killed as well. And this afternoon, as you've heard, we're going to be praying here for those people. Because our brothers and sisters are. There's huge prejudice around the world. And if you don't know about it, come along at 4 o'clock and you'll find out more about it. I'm going to be here. Jackie's going to be here. And we can pray about it. This is not what Jesus taught us, is it? It's not at all what Jesus taught us, because he taught us not only to love our neighbour, but to love our enemies, to pray for our enemies. In fact, he went much further than anybody had ever gone. But did he practice what he preached? Did he practice what he preached? Well, of course he did, and we're going to look at some verses in a moment from Matthew's account of his life. But before we do that, I just want to remind you, or maybe inform you, of the political and the economic climate of the times. So around 63 BC, the Israelites were in turmoil. There was a civil war, and the Romans came in and they conquered Jerusalem. And Julius Caesar and his Senate realized they're going to have to do something different to keep this group of people, these Israelites, under control. So they did. They appointed a client king, Herod, he was a Jew, to keep control of what was going on in the country. Herod goes on a spending spree, a building spending spree. He starts expanding the temple. He made it look much more like a Roman building. He starts building forts across the country for the soldiers. And he starts building new cities, some of which he named after the Roman emperor. But of course, it all had to be paid for. All of this building has to be paid for. Who's going to pay for it? Taxes. People were taxed again. There was tax for Rome. There was tax for Herod. They were still a temple state, so they had to pay a tithe to the temple. They had to pay for the priesthood. And they were taxes and taxes and taxes, such that people were weighed down by this financial burden. Absolutely weighed down by it. They fell into debt, and worst of all, they started to lose their land inheritance. That was so serious at that time. As far as they were concerned, this is most of the Israelites. They hated the Romans. They thought they were just a bunch of foreign Italians who'd come in and caused them all sorts of hardship. So you get the picture. This is the climate. This is the political and economic climate that Jesus is in. And we're going to pick up the story when he's just completed a sermon, now known as the Sermon on the Mount. And if you haven't read it for some while, I would encourage you to read it. It's in Matthew's account of his life, 5, 6, and 7. So he's completed his sermon. He comes down off of the hills back into his hometown of Capernaum, which is on the shores of Lake Galilee, of course. When up to him comes a Roman centurion. And that's where we're going to pick up the story. It's going to come up on the screen. So Matthew's account, chapter 8 and verse 5. When Jesus had entered Capernaum, a centurion came up to him asking for help. "Lord," he said, "my servant lies at home, paralyzed and suffering terribly." Jesus said to him, "Shall I come and heal him?" Now, I've read those verses many times, but it's never really struck me about the significance of Jesus' response. So I've just told you about the political, I've told you about the economic situation, and here's a Roman and a centurion to boot. And he walks up to Jesus. Not a hint of prejudice from Jesus. He doesn't and think about it. You know, it's not, "Oh, I need to think about this." No, immediately Jesus said, "Can I help you?" Immediately engages with this Roman. How is that? How could that possibly be? It's because Jesus saw an individual standing in front of him, asking for help. End of story. That's what Jesus saw. Here is an individual and he's asking for help. And he immediately engages and responds. He says, "Yeah, of course I'll come and help. I'll come and heal him." But then Jesus is taken aback by the Roman centurion's response. Because he replies, "Lord, I do not deserve to have you come under my roof. Just say the word and my servant will be healed. For I myself am a man under authority, with soldiers under me. I tell this one, go, and he goes. This one, come, and he comes. And I say to my servant, do this, and he does it. When Jesus heard this, he was amazed. And he said to those following, truly, I tell you, I've not found anyone in Israel with such great faith. Such great faith. I say to you that many will come from the east and the west. He's talking about non-Jews when he says that. They would have understood that. Many will come. In other words, people who are different from us, quite different from us, look different from us, behave differently from us, not Jews, but many will come from the east and the west. And will take their place at the feast with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. But the subjects of the kingdom, that's the Jews themselves, the subjects of the kingdom, will be thrown outside into the darkness where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Then Jesus said to the centurion, go, let it be done. Just as you believed it would. And his servant was healed at that moment. It's a remarkable story. It really is remarkable. You know, it's remarkable because Jesus engages with this Roman. It's remarkable because of the faith of the centurion. And when he says, you know, lots of people are going to come into the kingdom that aren't Jews, lots of different people from around the world. Well, they will, providing that we engage with them, provided that we will engage with them, then they will come into the kingdom because they'll hear the gospel, they'll hear the word. Remarkable story. Jesus engages with a hated Roman centurion. But I do want to make a point before I talk a little bit more about prejudice, and this is the point, that engagement, which Jesus clearly does, and he wants us to do, engagement is not necessarily endorsement. Engagement is not necessarily endorsement. What do I mean by that? Well, clearly, Jesus engages with this soldier. He sees an individual. He needs help. He engages with him. No question, no prejudice whatsoever. But that does not mean he endorses the Romans occupying his country. He doesn't endorse that at all. And he certainly does not endorse their practice of crucifying anyone who doesn't go along with what they think. He's not endorsing that, but he is engaging with this Roman officer. And we need to keep that in mind. We must engage with people. It doesn't necessarily mean, though, that we endorse what they're thinking or saying or their behavior, but we need to engage. So where do you stand on this issue of prejudice? Where are you? Have you got any prejudices? I'm sure you can see them in other people. We can all see them in other people. I'm sure you see it in different newspapers. One is prejudice this way, one is prejudice that way. You see it on the news, on the television. There are prejudices everywhere. But what about you? You know, just a few verses before this account of Jesus and the centurion, as I said, he's preaching a sermon. It's the Sermon on the Mount. And he says many, many things, well worth rereading. But one thing he does say is, why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother or sister's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye? And what he's saying is, start by examining yourself first. And that's what I'm saying. When it comes to prejudice, let's start by examining ourselves first. And you'll find that you do have prejudices. We all do. I do. But once you do identify what that prejudice is or what they are, and then ask yourself this question, where does that come from? What is the root cause of that prejudice? And oftentimes you'll find that it is fear. We're singing about fear early on. It's fear. This person or this people group, well, they don't look like me. They don't speak like me. They don't dress like me. They don't eat the same food as me. And that leads on to a prejudice. And when we stick a label on, just like I did with Gary, that is an alcoholic, waste of time. It leads to a prejudice, and it leads to us sticking labels on people. And you'll end up, and you might well find yourself saying something like, well, they're all the same. You can't trust them. That's prejudice. Or, and I swear somebody said this, I'd already decided I was going to say this, but somebody actually said this to me this week. I'm not a racist, but why even say it? They did. I swear, somebody actually said that to me this week. Or then there's, I'm not against the French or any other nationality you want to name or people group. I'm not against the French, but it's a prejudice. And it happens when we stop seeing people, a person or a people group as individuals. That's when it happens. We stop seeing them as individuals. We stick a label on them. And it makes us feel quite comfortable then in our prejudice. They're all the same. All the same. So the first thing we need to do is to be honest with ourselves and to say, do you know what? I am prejudiced against this or that or whatever it is. That's the first thing. But then we need to challenge it when we see it in other people. Because it does need to be checked. It doesn't have to be confrontational. So if you hear somebody saying something like, well, you can't trust them, they're all the same, you can gently, just very gently say, really? All of them? Exactly the same? And of course, that will just make people stop and think what they're saying. What am I saying? Of course, they're not all the same. No, nobody's the same. We need to check it. We need to challenge it. You see, when our thinking and when our behavior based on our prejudices becomes as habitual as brushing our teeth, then there's a danger. Because we stop recognizing that it is a prejudice. We stop even thinking about it. It just comes out. It's just part of who we are. And we have to stop it. Prejudice is not harmless. Because it leads to extremes. It leads to rejection. It leads to persecution. It leads to hatred. It leads to violence. And the truth is that prejudice is like a cancer. It's almost never benign. Never. It's like a cancer and it grows. So we need to identify it. And then we need to do something about it. We need to stop it as part of our behavior, part of our speech, part of our thinking. We need to stop it. Because that's what Jesus taught. And that's what he demonstrated when he met with that Roman centurion. I'm going to give us a few minutes to think about this. Think about ourselves. Don't start thinking about somebody else because that's always the danger. Oh, I hope so-and-so is listening to this. No. Don't do that. Think about yourself. I'm going to give you just a few minutes to do that. And then I'll pray for us. But to help us in our thinking, I'm going to read the last two verses from Psalm 139. I always mention Psalm 139. But these are great verses. Because this is what these verses say. Search me, God. And know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. Could have been, test me and know my prejudices. See if there is any offensive way in me and lead me in the way everlasting.